From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we talk with science writer and author Daniel Oberhaus about AI's growing role in psychiatry in his new book, The Silicon Shrink, How Artificial Intelligence Made the World an Asylum. Then we talk with Peter Trappa. He's the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Utah about the unique programs and resources the College of Science offers students. Stay with us. We'll be right back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Among the many promises that AI claims to deliver, psychiatry is on the list. With its massive database of mental conditions, psychological studies, and data on human behavior, AI is declaring its ability to detect mental disorders with superhuman accuracy, provide affordable therapy for those who can't afford or can't access treatment, and even invent new psychiatric drugs. But according to our guest, this hype obscures an unnerving reality. Joining us to talk about AI's emergence in mental health treatment is Daniel Oberhaus, science writer and author of the new book, The Silicon Shrink, How Artificial Intelligence Made the World an Asylum. Daniel, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is a very different topic than the first book that we had you on for, which was about extraterrestrial languages. This is about mental health and the emergence of AI's involvement. Let's start off talking about your interest in this topic.
Yeah, it's a very different book than my first one, but I think what unites the two is just an interest in the human mind, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But, you know, as I discussed in the beginning of the book, it really is one that was forged in tragedy, in the sense of I had lost my younger sister to suicide shortly after her 22nd birthday. And she had been struggling with, you know, she had been diagnosed with several mental disorders throughout her life and really had a hard go of it for most of her young adulthood. And so in the aftermath of that, I think a pretty natural question for survivors of a suicide is like, could things have been different? Like different diagnosis, different drug, different treatment? Were there signs that we didn't pick up on? That sort of thing. I think these are very common questions. I was working as a technology reporter and at the time, and so my mind naturally drifted to, was there some sort of technology that we could have used to have helped her? And, you know, in the process of mourning and going through all of her kind of digital footprint and cleaning things up, it just really struck me how much data there was about my sister. And, you know, at the time, AI was not what it was today. This was around 2018. But having tracked the AI space pretty closely, you know, I started to kind of spin on, hey, you know, maybe this data could have actually been useful in ways that would have, you know, perhaps led to a better outcome for her. So started digging into it out of, I guess, personal interest is a weird way to describe it. But that was, you know, it was a very personal issue that led me down this road. And the more I looked into it, the more it was blindingly clear that, you know, not only would this likely not have helped her, but that we may be on the cusp of something, you know, pretty dark as a society in terms of trying to apply this technology to psychiatry and just mental health more broadly. So that's how it all got started. And what's been interesting is over the past, you know, 6 years since the genesis of this project, is AI really has hit the mainstream in a major way. Tens of millions of people are using ChatGPT every day. And as it turns out, a lot of them are using them as psychiatrists. So it turned out to be a bit of a prescient topic.
You bring up a good point, because most of the things we've seen about AI are negative, and the negative effects on human behavior, or, you know, even AI encouraging and causing suicides in young people. How is it that where did this thought come from that, well, let's take this possibly nefarious tool and reframe it as something that's going to help? I don't see how, again, it's how can that actually be?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think with ChatGPT and these large language models, it's being asked quite a bit more, but I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that the link between AI and psychiatry is about 80 years old, or I guess, you know, closer to 70, but it really goes back to the beginning of the field. Psychologists were working very closely with computer scientists in the 1950s and 1960s. You know, artificial intelligence was something that was seen as going to be directly related to our understanding of the human brain. And so these two fields were kind of married from the start. And actually at the first demonstration of ARPANET, which eventually became the internet, two of the apps that were on display there, one was an artificial intelligence psychologist, and the other one was a model of an artificial intelligence of a paranoid mental patient. And so these two fields have just been intimately linked from the beginning. And the reason for that actually goes back to the beginning of what we might consider to be modern psychiatry about 200 years ago, when it really became a medicalized field. The challenge has always been trying to find a unambiguous biomarker for, you know, what we now call mental disorders. And, you know, hundreds of years ago, people were slicing and dicing brains, looking at lesions, trying to figure out if there was a hole in your brain, essentially, that would account for what we might now recognize as bipolar disorder. Those, of course, were not found. And so for the past, you know, 250 years or so, the holy grail of psychiatry has really been finding any sort of truly unambiguous biomarker that, you know, would allow us to say, you know, this person 100% has depression, or, you know, maybe not 100%. I feel like in medicine, that's a very high bar that basically nothing clears, but with more certainty, because the way that mental disorders are diagnosed today is, you know, generally it's going to be based on the DSM. And the way the DSM works is you have a collection of symptoms that hang together. And if you have a certain threshold of those symptoms, you know, say 10, you might be diagnosed with major depression disorder. And the problem with that is that, one, a lot of those mental disorders are not really backed by scientific evidence in the sense that, you know, we don't really know if this is a medical entity in the same way that you might think about, say, cancer being a medical entity. Some of these diagnoses were introduced basically by committee. A very common example of that is post-traumatic stress disorder, which was included as a mental disorder within the DSM decades ago, largely due to advocation for it being included from the veterans community. And so the reason for that is complicated, but essentially they just needed a way to get insurance for treatment. So it had positive social effects, but like that's very unique in medicine that you can create a disorder in this way. Usually there's evidence backing its existence. The second problem with that is when you do symptom-based diagnosis of a mental disorder, it's largely due to a clinician, their subjective evaluation of that patient. Is that patient actually have a symptom, and do all those symptoms collectively represent what we would call this disorder? So the holy grail for psychiatry has really been finding a way to move beyond that and to have, you know, more objective and quantifiable ways of diagnosis. And so a lot of these symptoms, some are behavioral, some are mood related, et cetera. And so AI held this promise of saying, well, if I can quantify every single one of your behaviors, if I have a way that I can actually measure your mood, then I can quantify whether or not you're in a depressive state using actual data, as opposed to what you tell me once a week when you visit me as a psychiatrist in the clinic. It's a very attractive idea. We've looked at that from a biomedical lens for almost a century now. And now with this kind of new data-driven paradigm we've entered, where we're awash in human behavioral and psychological data in many respects, now maybe is the time that we can actually use these tools that feed on large data and get better from them to take all this human behavioral data and usher psychiatry into this new data-driven paradigm. So that started about a decade and a half ago at the NIMH. They were very much leaders there. That's the National Institutes of Mental Health in the US. Tom Insel was very much a big proponent, the director of that institute. And since then, it's just exploded. There's just a tremendous amount of research being done in this space.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with journalist Daniel Oberhaus. He's written a new book called The Silicon Shrink: How Artificial Intelligence Made the World an Asylum. This is all so interesting, Daniel, because in a way, even the advent or the onset of using the DSM to recognize mental illnesses, it was an attempt to be less subjective, right? You check all these boxes, it seems kind of objective, and you arrive at this diagnosis, right? And I know the DSM has been around for how long? I mean, I know there have been like four or five versions of it or updates.
About 100 years, but it didn't really become the clinical reference manual it is today until the post-Freudian period around the 60s. It was heavily influenced by psychoanalysis for the first two editions. And then the DSM, as we recognize it today, started with DSM-3, where they, to your point, tried to make it a bit more rigorous and make sure that we had agreement amongst psychologists and clinicians who are seeing and treating these mental disorders that you should have broad clinician agreement in the sense of like, if we look at the same patient, are we going to arrive at the same diagnosis? That was the goal of the DSM-3 that kind of led to this symptom checklist approach to mental diagnostics that we have today.
Right. So, you know, it's so prescient now, the artificial intelligence influences on our entire world and how much people are both excited and scared about it. It's really interesting, though. I mean, you know, your sister passed away in 2018, and so sorry for this tragic loss that is really the genesis for you having written this book and researched this. But to what degree in 2018, you know, had she been treated under the influence of the employment of artificial intelligence?
So she had never used any tools that were driven by artificial intelligence. You know, even in 2018, the field was pretty young compared to what it is today, just 6 years later. But she had gone through intensive inpatient therapy, outpatient therapy, a variety of different drugs, you know, electroshock therapy. So the treatments that are conventional and are often actually quite effective, like I don't want people to walk away from this thinking that drugs have never helped anybody or ECT has never helped anybody. That's not my take at all, but they didn't help her. And part of the reason might have been, well, was she being treated for the wrong thing? Like, were her diagnoses even correct? Were we chasing something that may not have existed? And so the promise of artificial intelligence for the people who are proponents of it is that that question goes away. Like, we could say with more certainty, someone has this particular disorder, and then we can also begin to track outcomes in a better way where we can say, okay, they're responding to this drug better or they're not, et cetera, with around the clock monitoring. Because unless you're in an inpatient facility, she was meeting with a psychiatrist maybe once a week, could check in, but like that's a lot of time spent outside the clinic where the clinician does not have access to her behaviors, her emotional state, et cetera.
Well, Daniel, you're talking about how you just mentioned that, you know, you didn't know if some of these treatments would have worked or wouldn't have worked. Well, with the traditional system as it is now, there are checks and balances and there's training and there's certifications and there's check-ins with the therapists themselves to make sure that they're staying on top of the latest information. But who's going to be checking AI? And will an AI psychiatrist just do as it pleases without the checks and balances and trainings?
Yeah, and it's a critically important point, and I go into it at length in the book. Is, you know, there's multiple dimensions to what you had just said. So at the top of this conversation, you had mentioned, you know, there's concerns right now about AI having maybe, you know, precipitated a young adult's suicide. And then there's countless examples in the book of similar instances. This is not a new thing. This has been happening for years now. So there's that risk. I think that, to me, is something that will likely get solved through better technology, but I don't think it'll ever go away. Then there's the question of responsibility. So when that happens, who is responsible? Is it the engineers who are building it? We haven't really solved that as a society. I mean, these are statistical engines that are, you know, responding to you. It is not a person on the other side of it. And statistics is not always going to get everything right. And I don't think expecting 100% perfection is the answer there. But, you know, I guess the other portion of this is, you know, around like data and just like patient safety. There's also several examples in the book of, you know, these systems are taking in some of the most sensitive personal data you can imagine. I mean, it's, you know, we're talking about your mood, your biometrics, your thoughts, your behaviors, your location, everything is, you know, what these systems demand in order to work as well as they do. And of course, you know, no data can be perfectly protected. And so there's been several instances of that data being, you know, misappropriated for other uses that have no psychiatric use case whatsoever. You know, in one famous instance, the data from a suicide hotline that was being managed with AI was then used to train telemarketing software. There's been data that's been hacked. So it's a really thorny issue. The issue of responsibility, though, there isn't that responsibility to the patient that all physicians have, and, you know, typically have by law. These are, you know, when you go into a clinician's office, you can expect that that data is going to be held in confidence, and there are certain circumstances in which they must, you know, notify outside people about what was said. But for most cases, that's not true. Whereas the data that you feed into some of these AI therapists, for instance, is not subject to HIPAA restrictions. It's not considered medical data. part of the reason for that is a very interesting one, is if you look at some of the bigger therapy bots in the space, and I won't name names here, but it's probably the one you're thinking about if you're familiar with the space, is they are very careful about not calling themselves therapists. They are, you know, they call themselves everything but that. And there's a very important reason for that, because as soon as you do, now you're entering into medical territory, whereas they're essentially self-help apps is what they're labeled. So they're not subject to FDA restrictions. They do not have to go through clinical trials. And the apps that have gone through clinical trials, it's very worth reading their peer review, because you'll find that the clinical trials are very weak. They're very small sample sizes. They often don't show the results that they're claiming to on their website. So the marketing speak and what is actually demonstrated in terms of these effectiveness of these tools is limited to non-existent in the vast majority of cases. And that includes the biggest names in the space.
Daniel, you talk about, and I think this is a very interesting and important term, the surveillance economy, and how the psychiatric AI is really a part of that. Tell us more about this idea of surveillance economy, because we are all participating in it, whether we know it or not.
Sure. So the kind of the foundation of that idea comes from a woman named Shoshana Zuboff, who is a professor at Harvard and coined this idea of surveillance capitalism, where you know, the data that we spit off every day by interacting with digital devices is commoditized, bought and sold, et cetera. And so, you know, kind of looking at that as, you know, the current state of capitalism that we're in. And without saying anything about capitalism, I think there's, you know, a pretty important point there, because this can be applied to various sectors. And so in the case of, you know, psychiatric AI, these tools for the first time are capturing data that have these mental health implications. So this is kind of like a new frontier in what, you know, Professor Zuboff would have called surveillance capitalism, where all of a sudden this data that used to be, you know, confined to a clinic or basically not being collected is now being collected, and it is being monetized. There's hundreds of millions of dollars flowing into psychiatric AI tools from the venture space. There's, you know, billions of dollars being invested in it at a federal level for research. And then, you know, as I had mentioned earlier, this data is not always staying with the app. And so for the first time, this data is being bought and sold. And the broader implications of that were really, you know, the reason why I decided to spend so much of my the past few years writing this book, is because the trouble with psychiatric AI as it exists today is it must collect as much personal data about you as possible, because we don't yet have very strong correlations between the types of data that might be able to be collected by a machine and its concordance with a mental disorder. And what I mean by that is, you know, there's a variety of like mood tracking AIs, for instance, that look at various vital signs. They might look at your eyes, you know, see how your pupils are growing, that sort of thing. They might look at the tenor of your voice when you're speaking, not necessarily what you're saying, but just like the register of how you're saying it, the speed of the way you type. All this digital exhaust is now being trying to be correlated with these mental disorders as defined within the DSM. And the problem with that is that doesn't ever stop, right? Because psychiatric disorders are so multifaceted that they do have behavioral components, they have mental components, they have all these various things. So you need to collect data basically about your entire life. And the problem with this is that when you put that in the mental health context, you basically create this surveillance dragnet, because if you take suicide, for instance, like there's a lot of data showing that, you know, timely intervention is incredibly important. Like a few minutes can make a huge difference. So if you want to make sure that you catch everybody with a certain mental disorder and make sure that they get the treatment that they need, you essentially have to cast an around the clock complete dragnet to make sure that you catch those people and are able to provide support when they need it, because time does matter. And, you know, this sounds kind of maybe crazy and conspiratorial, but you're already kind of starting to see this. You know, schools are implementing software on students' computers, often, you know, without their knowledge. I think the New York Times actually just had a big story about this, to do suicide monitoring. Well, it turns out a lot of those tools aren't actually that effective, but they are just monitoring students' online habits around the clock from very young ages. And so as a society, I think we need to have a debate is, you know, where does that stop? Because similar tools are being implemented in workflow software to increase, you know, in the name of employee mental health, but really to increase productivity, because a happy employee is going to be a more productive employee. And so we can say, well, maybe that's a good thing if they're a happy employee, but, you know, what's the trade-off with these sorts of things? You know, on our phones, we increasingly have apps that are, you know, monitoring all sorts of biometric data. And it's amazing what we're trying to correlate. It's like your GPS location, you know, the speed that you're typing into your phone, not what you're saying, just how you're typing it. All of these things we're trying to say we can correlate with, say, major depression or anxiety disorder. So this surveillance state kind of just grows, and it's in the name of mental health. It gives basically carte blanche to monitor all of everything that we do for our own good. That's a very hard thing to push back on, because it might save lives. And a lot of people argue that it does. And I think in some cases they might be correct. You know, what is the cost? Are we comfortable giving that over to the private sector or the government or whoever in the name of our own good?
Wow. It is kind of conspiratorial, isn't it? Just to even talk about it. I'm wondering, Daniel, if you have any caveats in terms of, well, until this conversation, I didn't know that there were self-help apps out there. Are there any that our listeners should really be aware of, I guess, is a question that, I mean, we should be aware of everything that's surveilling us, but are there any, you know, real red flags you want to put up for our listeners?
I mean, I think in general, without naming any particular service, is just, it's like my general recommendation to everyone would be don't use them. However, you know, one of the main justifications for a lot of these therapy chatbots, for instance, is that, you know, the vast majority of US counties don't have a practicing mental health professional within them. Like, access to mental health services is a massive problem. There's a shortage of clinicians, and the mental health burden is just becoming tremendous in this state. So there are people who need help, who want help, and who can't access help. And these tools are promising a solution to that. Is it better than nothing is the question that I want answered. And right now the answer is we don't know. There's some data suggests that there is, but like I said earlier, that data is pretty weak. And a lot of these chat services, they weren't positioned as therapists. They were self-help bots. So they're not trying to say, hey, we're the same thing as a CBT clinician you would go to see in person, even though they functionally act that way. And people use them that way. People are using ChatGPT that way. And in fact, you know, initially OpenAI had said, you know, we don't provide medical advice, but then they actually rolled that back and started to kind of embrace how people were using it in this way. My strong recommendation is, you know, maybe don't use ChatGPT as your therapist, but I've also heard from people directly who have said it has helped them. So who am I to say? All I would say is just, it's important when you're interacting with these tools to be aware that there is very scant data. I would highly suggest looking to see if they are peer reviewed. Do they actually show that they help? Spend some time getting to know maybe the risks of that. I think this is something that's maybe not talked about enough, is how is your data being used? Is it being protected? Mm-hmm. And, you know, tread with caution. But I would also advocate the same advice for if you're going to see a human clinician, right? Because they're people too. People make mistakes. And yeah, we're talking about pretty serious issues. So my general kind of takeaway from this is, like, it's not the technology that's the problem. AI is actually quite good. The problem is that we just don't really understand enough about psychiatric disorders to apply these statistical machines in this field yet. Could it happen someday? Sure. But first we need to figure out what we're actually talking about. We need to learn more about mental disorders before we try to make this. And you could argue that AI will get us there, but that's not how it's being used right now. Right now it's being used with these faulty DSM-based criteria to diagnose at scale. So jury's out, but my main takeaway would be tread with caution with all AI psychiatric tools.
So is there any oversight by psychiatric professionals on the development of these apps and things, or is it purely bots taking information off of the DSM and the checklist and generating its own self-help apps or diagnostic apps or whatever?
Yeah, the good news is the you know, the academic research community and the clinical community has been heavily involved in this. I think people are really excited about this if they work in this space. And there's a lot of really great research being done, and I'm fully in support of research. You know, for instance, I would like highlight John Torres, who works at Beth Israel and Harvard. He's one of the leaders in digital psychiatry and really a pioneer here, doing tremendous work there. So clinicians and academics are certainly giving input. As for the individual apps, you'd have to look into how they were actually trained and built.
Well, Daniel, thank you for sharing your story with us, especially with your sister. I hope that this book was really cathartic in healing through that. Our guest today has been Daniel Oberhaus. He is a science writer and author of the new book, The Silicon Shrink, How Artificial Intelligence Made the World an Asylum. And this is an important book for everybody to read, especially as we all delve into our own mental health and resources out there. So Daniel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for your time, Katie and Lynn.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
The University of Utah is a global leader in science and technology, education, research, and development. And leading these endeavors is Peter Trappa, Dean of College of Science. He has previously served as the chair of Department of Physics and Astronomy, and prior to that, the chair of the Department of Mathematics at the university. In addition to overseeing these departments, Peter has also been involved in the Wilkes Center for Climate Science and Policy and is the founder of the Science Research Initiative. Peter Trappa, thank you for joining us and taking the time. Peter, thank you for taking the time to join us on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks, Katie. It's great to be here.
Well, let's get started. Tell us a bit. You started your academic journey at MIT and then Harvard. It started in mathematics. How did you go from math to academic leadership?
Well, first of all, when I was just starting my career, I was, of course, focused on my own research, which was on the interface of math and theoretical physics. And Utah was one of the very best places for me to kind of make my career. And I was drawn here for that reason. But as I sort of advanced through the ranks, it became clear that in addition to kind of my own teaching and research, that I could make a big impact through these leadership roles in sort of advancing research at the institutional level, and especially delivering for our students at scale. So I think that kind of potential for broader impact really is what drove me to consider some of these leadership positions.
Well, let's talk about the importance of these leadership positions, because we've talked to so many scientists and educators and researchers from the U and other universities. And I think most of us just envision, you know, the chair of these departments is sitting in an office behind a big desk. But I'm imagining there's a lot more to this position. What is it that you actually do? And how is it that this role that you now serve in, how can that affect change and expansion of science and technology education?
At the moment, as everybody knows, I'm sure all your listeners are well aware that, you know, there's a lot of pressures on higher education, and we have to be especially attentive to those pressures at this moment. And at the bottom of it, one of the most important things that we can do is really deliver an educational experience for our students that sets them up for rewarding careers, economic stability, and really kind of delivers a positive return on their investment in their education. So we think a lot about this and about the best way to develop programs that promote transformational experiences, which set our students up for success. And what distinguishes a research institution like ours from a lot of other higher ed institutions is that we can bring to bear our prominence in research to integrate experiences that are relevant for our students and to promote their success. So that's kind of like the high level strategy that we bring every day to it. And on the science side, we've kind of identified a few areas of strategic importance: life sciences, science plus computation, and also earth and environmental science. And within those kind of three broad areas, we kind of drill down on the programmatic and research elements to integrate them ultimately to deliver the best kind of outcomes for our students.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Peter Trappa. He is from the University of Utah College of Science. He's the current dean, and he's also a professor of mathematics. And we're talking to him about how the College of Science so navigates the educational atmosphere now and environment. And, you know, Peter, so, you know, we mentioned in the intro that you went to Harvard and MIT, no shabby places, or you were involved with those institutions, which speak for themselves. The University of Utah is a public institution, a state school, has to really prove itself. And, you know, over the years that we've been hosting this show for over a decade, we have learned that the University of Utah is one amazing institution. And when we think about it, I mean, like number one in gaming, for example, you know, so in your STEM related majors and things like that, programs, it's very strong. And then bioengineering and biotech and things like that. When someone asks you, what has the University of Utah really made its name? Where has it gotten its name in the College of Science from doing what?
Yeah, so the origin story of science at the University of Utah starts in 1946, really, when Henry Eyring returned from Princeton University to the University of Utah and to found the graduate school. And he quickly started awarding graduate degrees in chemistry. He was a physical chemist, a physicist, and really just an absolute world-class scholar. And starting with Henry Eyring, there's just been this steady, positive trajectory. Chemistry department here is absolutely world-class in a number of disciplines, including biochemistry, everything from biochemistry all the way to computational chemistry. The mathematics department has a kind of a similar origin story that started in the 60s, and it was built around really an area of algebraic geometry where they rank in the top five in the entire world. And finally, one of the ones that people know very well, I think your listener base will know very well, is the biological sciences. People like Mario Capecchi was drawn, the origin story in biology really goes back to a visionary leader named Gordon Lark, who attracted people like Mario Capecchi from Harvard and Toto Oliveira, who's a world-class biochemist, and people like Mary Beckerle, who's now CEO of the Huntsman Cancer Institute, began their careers in the School of Biological Sciences and then migrated often to the health science campus. So there's so many things to point to. And another place that some of your listeners may know well is the huge telescope array out in the West Desert that monitors for ultra-high energy cosmic rays interactions in the atmosphere. Again, just a place that an experiment and a tradition that distinguishes Utah science from everywhere else.
Wow. Well, you know, higher education has a changing face, I feel like. Maybe even in the last 10 years, there have been more and more conversations about the rate of inflation. Yeah. In tuition is not commensurate with the rate of inflation elsewhere in the economy. And people are starting to question, do you really need a college education? And so maybe you could just address that a little bit and give us your take as a leader in academia.
Yeah, I think it's really important to be attentive to the value proposition of higher education. And I think we're going to see a lot of focus on that in the state, as well we should. I mean, the state is investing taxpayer dollars in the University of Utah, and they want to see what that value proposition is. And I think we'll continue to see a focus on that. So something I really believe that I want to be personally attentive to in my role. And if we look around, other states are maybe a year or two or a couple of years ahead of us in examining the value proposition. So there was a recent study at the University of North Carolina system. They looked at the return on the investment for various degrees. And what they found is that a bachelor's degree, on average, increases your earnings over the course of your career by $600,000, and a graduate degree would be $900,000. So clear positive return. Well, you might say, oh, that's just an average, you know, that's skewed one way towards the STEM disciplines and these other disciplines that aren't really providing such a return. But what the study at UNC for the UNC system showed is something like 93% of all of the degrees had a positive return on investment. So it's really important that we objectively quantify that and really get that message out to not only our stakeholders who are helping fund and float our institutions, but also prospective students and their parents. Now, it certainly is true that some disciplines are going to have a higher return. And, you know, I'm sitting here as Dean of Science, and the STEM disciplines do have higher returns than some of the other disciplines. And maybe it makes sense for us to invest a little bit more in them, and that's important. And to look at the portfolio of our workforce needs, say in the state of Utah, you know, the state is very interested in maintaining and building their ecosystem around tech and increasingly around life sciences. And I think that's something that we should participate in as a university to help fuel the economic interests of the state and really deliver that return. But the news here, despite the skepticism that you hear sort of often in the media and on the ground, but the news here is really good. The positive return on the investment is very clear to demonstrate that. And we need to continue making that case and being attentive. And if we're not delivering, we need to change course and do a better job.
Peter, I know one of the things that you've done to really help encourage that return on investments is the Science Research Initiative, where it's a program designed to allow undergraduate students from throughout the College of Science to participate in cutting edge research. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so one of the things that's pretty well established is that undergraduate research is really a transformative experience for students. It correlates with every sort of positive outcome, whether it's GPA or time to graduation or ultimately career placement and earnings potential. And so we started with a challenge. You know, we have something like 3,000 majors and we have 200 faculty. So the traditional model of undergraduate research has a faculty member working with a couple of students maybe. And so you just run the numbers and there's no way that you could scale that to meet the kind of bring these transformative opportunities to all our students. And so we developed after kind of surveying the landscape nationally, we developed our own model, as you say, called the Science Research Initiative, or SRI for short. That's our clever three-letter acronym. And the idea here is that we hook entering students. So they come in with a lot of enthusiasm and interest in science. And their first semester on campus, we kind of start building a cohort experience, give them a 1 credit hour introduction to research course that we scholarship every single student so that they don't have to pay for that class. And then starting in their second semester, they're placed in teams of researchers, could be 10 or 15 or even more students that are working on a thematic collection of problems together under the guidance of a faculty member or an advanced graduate student or postdoc. And they stay together as that team into their second year and then start rolling off into more traditional opportunities. Now, these projects and these research projects for entering students are really designed very carefully by our SRI team to braid in with the foundational math and science classes that those students are taking in their first and second year. And what I'm really excited about is what we're piloting starting this semester in collaboration with the state around the Life Science Initiative is a companion program, not for entering students, but for students who are about to graduate. And instead of the projects being sourced from faculty and braided into the curriculum, the projects are sourced from our industry partners in the life sciences industry so that the students are working on really relevant projects that our industry stakeholders need as they get closer to graduation. So I think this is actually a really big idea, this idea of project-based learning at scale, where you either are sourcing projects to braid with curriculum or braid with the needs of external stakeholders. And I think there's just tremendous potential. We have something like 650 students engaged in that this semester, and we'll continue to scale that. So we're aiming to hit every single student at some point in their career in science here. But I think there's also potential to take that model outside of science and, you know, work with our partners in engineering or increasingly cross-disciplinary. We're piloting big interdisciplinary projects around environmental science, for example, where, you know, you've got social scientists working with natural scientists, working with political scientists and things of that nature. So a lot of potential for this model. And I'm excited about it because we have measured we started longitudinal studies that have measured the impact on our students and the outcomes. The participants go through this program, have higher GPAs, are graduating at higher rates, are getting placed in better career opportunities. So excited about that.
Yeah. That sounds like a great program. Let's talk about the students, because I think as we have these conversations, most of us just assume these are straight out of high school, since we're in Utah, maybe right off their mission, coming into the University of Utah. And in most schools. But what is the percentage of maybe older students coming back, people that have worked in different careers? I think a lot of us would feel intimidated to go back into a science-related degree, but do you have any sort of ways to help bring these older students back in, or are you seeing an increase in this different demographic?
Yeah, certainly we're trying to be as attentive as possible to, you know, what sometimes are characterized as non-traditional students. So people are coming back after a break and trying to meet, as we do with all our students, but especially this population of students, we're trying to meet students where they are. And so the kind of on-campus experience that I was sort of sketching may not work for someone who has a family or is in between careers or what have you. So, you know, the pandemic kind of packed a lifetime of experience in sort of other modalities of delivery, you know, whether it's asynchronous online, complemented by regular convenings or other sort of online delivery mechanisms. And so we're investing a lot in that and really trying to understand how we can best meet our non-traditional students where they are. And that may mean not a traditional undergraduate degree. Maybe it's not a bachelor's degree. Maybe it's a certificate, or if they already have a degree and they're looking for a career change, maybe it's a professional master's program. And so we're experimenting and increasingly investing in all of those portfolio of opportunities.
That makes me wonder, Peter, what kinds of certificate programs you have in the College of Science that someone might come in and get, even someone who's coming from having a background in a non-traditional science background or field.
Yeah, so we've got a lot of certificates, and I can't go through all of them, but let me tell you a couple that we worked on with our friends in computer science. So we have a data fluency certificate and a data science certificate. And the data fluency is really targeted at sort of non-STEM students, people who need fluency and literacy in sort of the language and basic techniques of modern data analysis, but who are not going to apply, calculus-based methods to look at this methodology versus that methodology. And so that's our data fluency certificate. And then we also have a data science certificate, again, in collaboration with our Center for Data Science, which is in the School of Computing in our College of Engineering. And that one is much more kind of in the technical weeds of the methodology of modern data science. We also have just a completely different example would be a certificate in mining safety. One of the departments in the College of Science actually is mining engineering. And there's a huge need, as you know, around critical minerals and a focus on how are we going to get some of the stuff out of the ground in a way that, is environmentally responsible and yet, ensures, sort of stabilizes or ensures our national security against our geopolitical competitors. And so we have a certificate around mine safety, which is really something that we developed in response to what the needs are of our folks in that industry.
That's so interesting. The critical minerals, as we know, that we're going to have to, if we want to electrify the world, we're going to have to start mining more and more. And I would imagine somewhere like the University of Utah could really be cutting edge on those kinds of endeavors. So it's really interesting to know that you have a certificate program already. Well, that sends us into a conversation about the new Wilkes Center for Climate Science and Policy. And you were instrumental in joining the philanthropist Clay and Marie Wilkes in this endeavor. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, it was a big team effort. Clay and Marie Wilkes came initially to President Randall with their vision for what they thought was one of the most pressing, what is one of the most pressing challenges facing us, the challenges around a changing climate and the implications of that for all of us. And the Wilkes had this vision of establishing a center of excellence, which would build on the outstanding intellectual assets that we already had at the University of Utah, but would distinguish itself because it was the Wilkes weren't interested in just promoting great research in these areas, but really putting objective, best information in the hands of decision makers and policy makers who ultimately are going to impact the way that we address issues around a changing climate. That was a very broad vision, and we worked with the Wilkes's to crystallize that and polish that. And we launched it now 2.5 years ago. And there have been a few areas of focus on the research side, broadly speaking, fire, water, and air. There's been a big push to put best information in the hands of decision makers. The Wilkes Summit is an annual event which brings people from all over the world to discuss these issues. And the centerpiece of that is a prize, which is pitch sessions happen. Semifinalists pitch their ideas at the summit, and then ultimately a prize is awarded to the most promising technology or idea that would address climate solutions or climate resilience. So it's just been remarkable to watch how that center has had an impact in just 2.5 years. On the research side, I haven't even talked about all the student programs that are run through the Wilkes Center. Many are these experiential learning undergraduate research opportunities that I was mentioning earlier in collaboration with our SRI program. And another one which really strikes very close to home is the involvement of the Wilkes Center in leading a strike team on the Great Salt Lake. So there'll actually be a newsmaker's breakfast next week in our Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute, out of our Kempsey Gardner Policy Institute, which will discuss the second iteration of the strike team's report on the Great Salt Lake, which has really led to actionable items that we've seen in recent legislation to stabilize the level of the Salt Lake, of the Great Salt Lake.
Peter, as someone who came through the Professional Masters of Science and Technology program at the U, it was a really wonderful thing to have an alternative master's program that wasn't stuck in a specific silo, which has been the traditional degree program in the past and traditional departments. But the College of Science really does incorporate all of these scientific and engineering endeavors and disciplines. But I'm assuming you also partner with outside organizations like the English department or history or maybe even art. What sort of collaborations do you have that most of us would be surprised to hear about?
So I'll tell you, since you brought up games at the top, Katie, and by the way, always delighted to meet an alum and a great alum of our PMST program. So very happy that you were pleased with your experience there. But since you mentioned games at the top, one of the things that we have looked at very seriously is how we can incorporate a narrative experience in our undergraduate mathematics courses. So this seems like just an absolutely crazy idea. We kind of got an idea from what some other institutions around the country are doing in applications of immersive learning and virtual reality, particularly Arizona State. We've looked at what they're doing. And the idea is that one of the big challenges in a math class is student engagement. If you can get students engaged showing up, whether online or in person, in some sense, you've won half of the battle. And we're seeing different learning patterns among our students post-pandemic. And we're having to adapt to the what our students are expecting and the way that they are engaging. And so we're trying to foster kind of an innovative approach to how we engage students in say, a math class. And the idea is, you know, very roughly speaking, is that maybe we can organize the whole college algebra class around a hero's quest, which is sort of designed by a partner in English who designs the narrative. And then there's maybe this immersive learning piece, which is in partnership with our folks in games. And the hero's quest is all about, you know, slaying the problems of algebra or something like that. And because it really is, if you think about the way that we all engage, we really do engage in narratives. We love a good story. Human beings love a good story. And in science classes, which progress very linearly, oftentimes we don't see a story in our basic math and science classes. So can we capitalize on our natural inclination to stories in partnership with our friends in English or games to increase student engagement in something like a math class to ultimately deliver better results? So it's that kind of stuff that gets me really excited, actually, because it sounds like wacky and off the wall. And in some ways it really is wacky and off the wall, but I think there's something really important there. And if we can figure out the right way to do it, I think we can deliver great results for our students.
If you're a student and you really want to be involved in science and technology, but you're worried that you don't necessarily have the math skills or the science skills, but just listening to you talk about how it's a story as well, how could those students formulate their approach into these kind of programs?
Yeah, so you know, just to return to a theme that I mentioned earlier, is we really want to meet students where they are and make them see the University of Utah and their science classes here as a place where they, first of all, they belong and they can do their best work. You know, so it is really an intimidating environment to walk in to, or it was when I was a student. It could be a very intimidating environment to walk into a math class where you think that everybody else knows way more than you do, and on day one you're behind. And we're really trying to be very sensitive to that and help students feel like, you know, this is a place that they belong and they can do their best work. And yeah, I mean, getting a degree in math and science is hard. You're gonna have to put in the effort, but it doesn't mean that it's impossible or it's possible only for certain kinds of students. We really want to open that possibility up to all of our students, and through the right kind of engagement and the right kind of investment of their time and energy, we aim to design tracks where all of our students can succeed.
It really sounds so great. It sounds like the evolution of higher education moving in a direction that we would all like to see it go. As you've been talking, Peter, I've thought about my own, especially undergraduate degree way back in the, well, I won't say which decade, but
I got out feeling like I had no idea what was going on in the real world of you know, research, and what you're doing with the Science Research Initiative is just fantastic. And then also, just maybe as a means to wrap up, what you're doing to create partnerships among your students and these programs and industry.
Yeah, and I think that's a great place to kind of end on a high note, because this is really the future I see. So it's adapting that kind of project-based learning infrastructure that I was describing around SRI, and sourcing the projects from our industry partners. That's the way that we can nimbly adapt to what our industry partners need, right? Redesigning a class, redesigning a curriculum, a major is typically a multi-year undertaking. It's something that you can't just do on the fly, because when you start changing this piece over here, well, that affects, you know, the progression of courses over here. And so the traditional approach to sort of revising and iterating curriculum to meet the needs of industry often isn't fast enough, isn't nimble enough to really see what to react to what we're seeing, especially in tech industries and STEM industries. So I think this project-based learning idea, sourcing ideas from our industry partners, is the future of how we can set our students up for a really seamless transition into their next phase of post-graduation, their first job, their careers, the rest of their lives. And it's also that kind of nimbleness is important in another way, sort of from a meta perspective, because our students, we know, will change jobs many times, maybe even change careers many times. And working on a project where things don't always work the way that you expect them to is exactly the kind of skill set that you need in a fast-changing industry where you're going to reinvent yourself a few times. So that's the future for us, and I'm excited about that.
Well, our guest today has been Peter Trappa. He is the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Utah. Peter, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio and telling us about this amazing college and program that you have.
Well, it was a great pleasure to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to Cool Science Radio on KPCW in Park City, Utah. You can hear past shows on kpcw.org under the Shows tab. Again, you're listening to KPCW Park City at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County and 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. Stream us live on kpcw.org and the KPCW app, or ask your smart speaker to play KPCW. Play KPCW Radio. And coming up on Cool Science Radio in the next few weeks, we'll have a conversation about nuclear energy, a lot of truths, myths, and the importance of this alternative energy source, and also the resilience of coyotes. It's going to be very fascinating, so stay tuned.